Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. A senior Kenyan official says the government is freezing the assets of dozens of organizations and individuals that he said are suspected of financing Islamic extremist activities. The country's Treasury Principal Secretary said Wednesday that the freeze of assets applies to a list of 85 companies and individuals. The move is designed to choke the flow of money to the Islamic terror group Al-Shabaab that claimed responsibility for last Thursday's attack on Garissa University College that killed 148 students. This latest development comes as Kenya's Principal Secretary for Education, Dr. Richard Kipsang, says the bodies of those students are being released.
We have started the process of releasing the bodies of our beloved young ones, the students of Garissa University. And as from now, we are processing the release of the bodies.
The Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has vowed a sharp response to last week's attack. A state-run media outlet in Iran is reporting that Iranian Navy ships have left for waters near Yemen amid a Saudi-led airstrike campaign to halt the advance of the Iranian-backed Shiite rebels in the country. Iran's press TV Wednesday quoted a rear admiral as saying that the fleet will provide safety for Iran's shipping lanes and protect the country's interests in the high seas. An Afghan National Army soldier opened fire on NATO-led troops, killing one before getting shot and killed in return fire in eastern Afghanistan. A statement said that the incident in Jalalabad resulted in the death of one Resolute Support service member, and that statement came from the offices of the Resolute Support mission. The motive, however, for that attack is unknown. VOA News. The Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras met with Russian President Vladimir Putin for bilateral talks in Moscow Wednesday. This is Mr. Putin. During the meeting in the Kremlin, he indicated that Russia could lift its embargo on food imports from Greece. He said that between 2009 and 2013, the turnover between their countries had grown more than twice, according to Mr. Putin. But unfortunately, last year it decreased by 40% at once. Speaking to reporters after the meeting, the Russian president said that the leader of Greece did not ask for financial aid. Royal Dutch Shell has announced it's buying British gas producer BG for $70 billion, giving Shell a bigger share of the natural gas market as oil prices fall. The companies put out a joint statement Wednesday urging shareholders on both sides to approve the deal. This industry analyst says it's a gamble for Shell.
What's very interesting about this deal is that BG is not really an oil firm. BG is a gas producer. So clearly Shell is making a bet on a cleaner fuel. They're making a bet that gas will become an increasingly important fuel in the future rather than oil.
India's envoy to Pakistan has brushed aside Islamabad's assertions that rapid increases in its atomic arsenal are serving as a deterrent to another war between the rival nations. IL School reports.
Pakistani authorities insist the nuclear weapons have deterred another war with India, helping to maintain regional peace. Indian envoy to Pakistan, TCA Raghavan, dismisses these assertions, saying an increase in the nuclear arsenal is not a way of building confidence.
I believe the way forward is to address issues of political trust, address issues of concern with regard to terrorism and extremism.
Indian diplomat Raghavan disagreed with suggestions the nuclear negotiations between Iran and the United States sets an example for India and Pakistan to work together to ease growing nuclear dangers in South Asia. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
British police are hunting for a gang Wednesday who raided safety deposit boxes in London's major jewelry business district, making off with cash and gems in what local media said could be the country's biggest ever heist. The Metropolitan Police said the thief used heavy cutting equipment to get into the vault of the officially unnamed deposit business in Hatton Garden that's home to almost 300 diamond, gold, and gem dealers and more than 50 shops where they broke into the safety boxes. The news came from the Sun newspaper. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhiben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroonian refugees displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency in northern Cameroon say they are living in desperate conditions, going without food, water and medicine for days at a time. They complain the government and UN agencies are focusing solely on Nigerian refugees and ignoring their needs.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from northern Cameroon. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Ugandan police have arrested four people in connection with last month's murder of a local prosecutor who dealt with terror cases. And Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou says a coalition of military units from Niger and Chad has won several victories against the rebel forces of Boko Haram.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Kenya has taken strong economic action following last week's terrorist attack at Garissa University. The attack by Somalia's Al-Shabaab's militant group killed nearly 150 people at the university. The government has suspended the licenses of 13 Somali remittance firms. Also, the government has frozen the bank accounts of nearly 90 individuals and firms suspected of financing terrorism in the country. Somalia's central bank governor, Bashir Issa, tells Reuters that blocking remittances will have a devastating effect on Kenya's Somali community, which numbers about 1 million people. Kathleen Newland is co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington and director of the Migrants Migration and Development Program. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about Kenya's suspension of the Somali remittance firms.
Very much a double-edged sword. The Kenyan, terribly different from the actions that other governments have taken, including the United States and Great Britain, to really crack down on money transfer operations that they believe could be used to finance terrorist activities. But having said that, in all these cases, they're shutting down firms that ordinary Somalis rely upon for often very substantial proportions of their household income. That includes Somali refugees in Kenya, as well as Somali Kenyans who have relatives abroad.
Is there any way to put a figure on how much money might be affected by this move?
Well, it's difficult to say, you know, with any precision, but Kenya receives well over $1 billion a year in remittances. It's not broken down by ethnic group, so we don't really know how much of that sum is going to the Somali community in Kenya or Somali refugees. But the few sort of, you know, small-scale studies that have been done suggest that, you know, the sums in many cases account for a substantial portion of of families' income and household income, because the Somali community is pretty far-flung. You know, there's substantial Somali communities in the U.S., in Europe, and, you know, in other countries as well. So these remittance flows are important to people, and it's which is not to say that that they haven't, you know, that money from abroad hasn't gone to the Shabaab or other terrorist forces. So I guess what I would say is it's kind of a blunt instrument to just close money transfer operations without, you know, without making an attempt to really discover what which ones are being used by terrorist organizations. I think another effect of this action by the Kenyan government is going to be to further alienate the Somali-Kenyan community, which feels that it has been, you know, unfairly implicated in Shabab activities when, you know, the vast majority of Somali-Kenyans feel themselves more victimized by Shabab than sympathetic to it. So it's a blunt instrument, and I'm afraid that in addition to making life even more difficult for the Somali communities in Kenya, it also risks further alienating them from the government and thereby undermining their cooperation against Somali-based terrorists.
So are there any viable alternatives at this time to the firms that were handling the remittances?
And that was Joe DiCapua, who was speaking with Kathleen Newland. She's co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, and she spoke with Joe DiCapua.
Ugandan police have arrested four people in connection with last month's murder of a local prosecutor who dealt with terror cases. AP reports they were arrested in a Kampala suburb yesterday. One of the men is identified as Jamal Kiyemba, who reportedly was once detained at the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. No formal charges have been brought yet. Police say he's being questioned about the case and other crimes in Uganda. Prosecutor Joan Kagize was killed on March 30th when she got out of her car.
Twelve minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Global Movement for Tribal People's Rights, Survival International, says it has received reports that Ethiopia's Lower Omo Valley tribe, the Kwegu, is starving due to the destruction of their forest and the drying up of the river on which their livelihoods depend. The Kwegus live along the banks of the Omo River in Ethiopia's Lower Omo Valley. They are a tribe of 1,000 people who hunt, fish, and grow crops along the river banks. Survival International reports that the massive Gibe III Dam and large-scale irrigation taking place in the region is robbing the Kwegu of their water and fish supplies. Elizabeth Hunter is an Africa campaign officer for Survival International.
The situation with the Kwegu is extremely serious. Survival has received very alarming reports that they're now starving, and this is because they hunt and they fish and they grow plants along the side of the River Omo. All of this livelihood now, right as I speak, is being destroyed. And that is because, firstly, the Gibe III Dam, which is this massive hydroelectric dam, it'll be the tallest in Africa, is going to dry up or finish with the flood, which the Kwegu and other tribes depend on for cultivating in the rich silt of the flood alongside the riverbanks.
Hunter said, linked to the dam, a massive land grab is taking place under the direction of the Ethiopian government to create plantations along the Omo River.
The plantations, particularly the sugarcane plantation, the Kuraz project, which is a government-run project, is going to need a lot of water. So they're already siphoning off water into irrigation channels from the river. So for the Kwegu, this means that the fish are going to disappear. And as the plantations expand, they're saying that all the riverine forests, which they depend on for honey because they have hives up in the trees, has all been destroyed.
Hunter emphasized that the clearing of the land is forcing the Kwegu tribe to become dependent on other tribes and the government for survival. Alimayehu Tegenu is the Minister of Water, Irrigation and Energy for Ethiopia. He says the Gibe III Dam and the irrigation that is being done for their projects will not affect the water supply of the tribes along the Omo River banks.
The upper stream of the dam is in gorge, so it will not affect anybody in the gorge. Downstream side also, the dam will not affect the people because the water that we will release from the dam is a very regulated water. The people will not be affected by the dam.
However, Hunter said the Kwegus are being forced by the government into resettlement.
Well, the government claims this is all being done, you know, in the name of development. The big problem is that there has been no consultation or very little consultation, and certainly none of the tribal people who live in the Lower Omo have given their full, free, prior and informed consent to these projects, both the dam and the plantations. So this means, for example, the Kwegu say, we know absolutely nothing about this. The government come to us, they don't tell us anything. All they say is you're going to be forced to move off your land in this project known as villagization.
Minister Ali Manyehu said the Kwegu will receive a plot of land and access to water and irrigation from the sugar plantation. He says the government has discussed this directly with the Kwegu.
We have sufficiently discussed, and people currently, they request to be part of the sugar plantation. Accordingly, we accommodated and we will accommodate.
Minister Ali Manyehu says the tribes along the Omo riverbanks will benefit on a long-term basis from the dam and sugar plantations.
The sugar plantation is very far from the dam, and the life of the people is part of the sugar plantation program. There will be irrigation schemes for the people around the sugar plantation. The sugar plantation will improve the life of the people in that area.
In addition, he said while the tribes will not be relocated off of their land, they are building homes for them on their land.
No plan to mobilize to other places, but we have constructed houses for them to settle in their location.
Survival International's Elizabeth Hunter says her group was recently told by tribespeople along the banks that they do not want to live in new houses and were never asked what they wanted.
The other extremely worrying thing is the government has not come up with any compensation plan for these people who are being asked to give up everything, their livelihood, their way of life, that very deep connection they have as tribal people to the land, and no mitigation measures have been put in place.
Hunter said the Kwegu will receive 5 or 6 heads of cattle on the resettlements, which she says is nothing compared to the amount they have now. She said cattle are like money in the bank for the tribes people because when crops fail, the cattle can be traded at local markets for money for them to buy food. But without cattle to trade, they will no longer be independent. Hunter also pointed out that some people do want the benefits that go along with development, such as having schools and health clinics. But she said these benefits should not come at the cost of them having to give up their land. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Ugandan police have arrested 4 people in connection with last month's murder of a local prosecutor who dealt with terror cases. And Niger's president, Mahamadou Issoufou, says a coalition of military units from Niger and Chad has won several victories against the rebel forces of Boko Haram. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In more news around the continent, Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou says a coalition of military units from Niger and Chad has won several victories against the rebel forces of Boko Haram in recent weeks. Mr. Issoufou was in New York to promote UN support for a West African regional coalition to end 6 years of Boko Haram violence in Nigeria. In recent months, the insurgent forces have expanded their attacks to Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. The president of Niger predicted the defeat of Boko Haram fighters in the Lake Chad area. A spokesman for the Nigerian military says units from Niger and Chad have retaken four towns held by Boko Haram, Dauchi, Damasek, Gashagar, and Malafator. He says military forces killed about 300 Boko Haram insurgents and recovered a large cache of weapons. He says the victories are a result of a month-long campaign in Niger to secure the Lake Chad region.
Cameroonian refugees displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency in northern Cameroon say they are living in desperate conditions, going without food, water, and medicine for days at a time. They complain the government and UN agencies are focusing solely on Nigerian refugees and ignoring their needs. Moki Edwin Kindeka visited with some of these internally displaced people and reports from northern Cameroon.
Displaced school children sing here at a government school in Mora in northern Cameroon, some 25 kilometers from the Nigerian border. Their teacher, Feyu Alice, says the children study under very difficult conditions.
That one is overcrowded classroom. As you can see, I'm just managing. There's no way to even pass in class, but I'm trying my best. There are illness. You have cough, fever. Since the classroom is crowded, they're having wounds on their leg.
Lawanda Tekone, head teacher of government school in Kolofata, not far from Mora, says his school is finding it difficult to cope with Cameroonian children displaced by Boko Haram activity in their own country.
Ici au campus, ils sont au moins 520. Il y a beaucoup de choses qui manquent.
He says the more than 500 students in his school have just one portable water source and they do not have even a single latrine. He says they are living under desperate conditions. The government of Cameroon says at least 70,000 school children and 100,000 people have been displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. Fekwe Ngaha Joseph, chief of Amang village near Mora, says he has been asking well-wishers to contribute and take care of internally displaced persons seeking refuge in his village.
Depuis 8 mois, église par église, mosquée par mosquée, on collecte un peu de mille.
He says for 8 months running, they have been moving from mosque to mosque and from church to church, asking people to contribute maize, sorghum and millet to feed the hundreds of internally displaced people living in their village. Musa Ibrahim, whose 3 wives and 9 children were displaced from Fort Okol 2 months ago after an attack by Boko Haram fighters left at least 500 dead, says the food they received from the chief, Fekwe Ngaha Joseph, is largely insufficient.
Si vraiment les autorités nous comprennent, il faut qu'ils fassent quelque chose. Il y a les enfants qui ne trouvent pas à manger. Souvent, nous les grands, on n'arrive pas à manger.
He says because of acute food shortages, they keep the little they have for the sick and children, and that they drink pap without sugar and share each tablet of soup among many people. He says he is pleading with Cameroon authorities, the international community, and United Nations agencies to immediately come to their rescue. The Vice President of Cameroon's National Assembly, Joseph Mbandam, says Cameroon has been concentrating on fighting Boko Haram and not taking proper care of internally displaced persons.
The UN High Commission for Refugees takes care of foreigners who have drifted into Cameroon. But who takes care of Cameroonians who have been displaced? I think that the government is not taking care of the displaced populations. We think about soldiers, and we're not thinking of those who are going hungry, homeless, and have been sent away from their areas of subsistence.
Najat Rushdie, coordinator of the United Nations system in Cameroon, says the assistance is urgently needed to save lives of people suffering from the Boko Haram insurgency.
We need to work on the early recovery of the economy here, and you know that the security situation, unfortunately, is really, really having a huge impact on the economy. We have villages of 5,000, 7,000 people, so again, thanks to them and for their solidarity and generosity. But somehow we have also to have a number of accompanying measures, so we make sure that the social cohesion is there.
last month when he visited refugees and internally displaced persons in northern Cameroon. United Nations Refugee Chief Antonio Guterres said masses of people fleeing the terrorist group Boko Haram have created a crisis comparable to the refugee situation caused by Syria's civil war, and a shortfall of international funding was hampering the UN's ability to help the situation. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
Well, this Saturday, Nigerians go to the polls to elect state governors. The outcome of that vote could determine the true power President-elect Buhari can wield when he takes office. Mr. Buhari's All People's Congress Party has brought allegations of vote rigging in Imo State. It accuses outgoing President Jonathan's People's Democratic Party of using fake soldiers to prevent delivery of ballots to some areas during the presidential election. It says it fears a repeat of such a move in Imo State this Saturday. Besides governors, voters will also elect members of state assemblies. In news elsewhere, a state-run media outlet in Iran is reporting that Iranian Navy ships have left for waters near Yemen amid a Saudi-led airstrike campaign to halt the advance of Iranian-backed Shiite rebels in the country. Iran's press TV today quoted Rear Admiral Habbola Sayari as saying the fleet will provide safety for Iran's shipping lanes and protect the country's interest in the high seas. He said it will also seek to keep commercial ships safe from pirates. The fleet, which includes a destroyer and another vessel, is sailing to the Gulf of Aden and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, the main access point to the Red Sea for ships going to the Suez Canal. Egypt has also sent naval vessels to waters off the Yemeni coast. Tensions are high in Yemen due to the conflict between Houthi rebels and forces loyal to the country's internationally backed president, Rabo Mansour Hadi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on the television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa with host Shaka Sali. Good Luck Jonathan loses, but democracy wins in Nigeria. We'll look across Africa at the system of government where power is vested in the people. That's next, right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, there's need to have a native computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. The 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Many Ebola patients who are treated in hospital will survive and recover. Ebola is a serious disease, but when people have recovered, the doctors test them, and when the disease is all gone, they are discharged. The discharged patients cannot transmit Ebola. The virus has left their bodies, and they cannot pass Ebola to anyone, not their children, their other family members, people sitting next to them in the taxi or bus. Partners, however, must abstain or always use a condom for sex for 3 months after discharge from the health center. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ugandan police have arrested four people in connection with last month's murder of a local prosecutor who dealt with terror cases. And Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou says a coalition of military units from Niger and Chad have won several victories against the rebel forces of Boko Haram. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC. And in our feature segment, the UN says barring remittances from abroad in Somalia could have disastrous effects on the country. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swahib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots of African football news for us today.
Lots on the plate this evening, Kim. The Confederation of African Football's Executive Committee on Wednesday awarded Gabon the hosting rights to the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament. Our VOA football fans will remember Gabon co-hosted the 2012 Nations Cup with Equatorial Guinea. Meeting in Cairo, the CAF officials chose Gabon over bids from Algeria and Ghana. All three countries made presentations to the CAF Executive Committee before the vote was taken. Also Wednesday, CAF conducted the draw for the 2017 Nations Cup qualifying competition. Morocco and Tunisia, which were facing bans, are both in Gabon 2017 qualifying. CAF had banned the Moroccans from taking part in the next two Nations Cup tournaments after they did not host this year's competition. But the Moroccans were reinstated after winning their appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lausanne, Switzerland. And the Tunisians avoided a ban after apologizing to CAF for accusing African football's governing body of bias. The Tunisians are in Group A, along with Togo, Liberia, and Djibouti. Let's take a quick look now at the 12 other Nations Cup qualifying groups for Gabon 2017. Group B has the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, Central African Republic, and Madagascar. Group C features Mali, Equatorial Guinea, Benin, and South Sudan. In Group D, it's Burkina Faso, Uganda, Botswana, and the Comoros Islands. Group E has Zambia, Congo-Brazzaville, Kenya, and Guinea-Bissau. In Group F, it's Cape Verde, Morocco, Libya, and Sao Tome. Group G has two African giants, Nigeria and Egypt, as well as Tanzania and Chad. Group H has Ghana, Mozambique, Rwanda, and Mauritius. In Group I, we have Ivory Coast, the reigning African champion, along with Sudan, Gabon, and Sierra Leone. In Group J, it's Algeria, Ethiopia, Lesotho, and Seychelles. Group K features Senegal, Niger, Namibia, and Burundi. In Group L, it's Guinea, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Swaziland. And finally, in Group M, we have Gambia, South Africa, Mauritania. I mentioned Gabon in Group I. Well, the Gabonese earned an automatic berth as the host of the tournament. Their matches against Ivory Coast, Sudan, and Sierra Leone will be considered friendlies. The winners of the 13 groups will book their places at the Nations Cup, along with the two top runners-up, excluding Group I, Gabon's group. In that group, only the winner will qualify. So Ivory Coast must be considered the favorite to get out of that group. The qualifying action for Gabon 2017 is scheduled to kick off in June. And on that note, let me give a Sunny Side of Sports shout out for Bill Werkinger, my Voice of America producer this evening. Kick it, Bill!
Kick it!
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C.
The Voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. President Obama is a big sports fan. And on Monday at the White House, he invited some members of my beloved Washington Wizards basketball club, as well as Danish tennis star Caroline Wozniacki, to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to have some fun and participate in clinics for children. President Obama and five Wizards players, John Wall, Bradley Beal, Paul Pierce, Kevin Serafin, and Garrett Temple, participated in a shooting game on the White House basketball court with a group of children. More basketball news. Let's give a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Lady Huskies from the University of Connecticut. They won their record-extending 10th national title on Tuesday night, beating Notre Dame 63-53 in the women's championship game in Tampa, Florida. It was the third consecutive title for the Lady Huskies. All 10 of those national titles have come under the tutelage of Gino Auriemma, the head coach of Connecticut. He now ties John Wooden, the late great John Wooden of UCLA, for most national titles in college basketball, men and women, with 10. Once again, congratulations to the Huskies of Connecticut celebrating their 10th national title in women's basketball. In pro basketball news, the Atlanta Hawks have spread their wings and soared to unprecedented heights of success this NBA season. The Hawks set a single season record with their 58th victory of the season Tuesday night, when they beat the visiting Phoenix Suns 96-69. Atlanta got 16 points each from DeMar Carroll and Jeff Teague. Mike Muscala, starting for injured All-Star forward Paul Millsap, also scored 16 points for the Hawks, and Al Horford added 14 points. Atlanta will end the regular season as the Eastern Conference champion, giving them the top seed in the upcoming NBA playoffs. Meanwhile, the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs are playing some excellent basketball ahead of the playoffs. The Spurs spanked the Oklahoma City Thunder Tuesday night, 113-88. It was San Antonio's eighth straight victory. Kawhi Leonard matched a career high with 26 points to lead the Spurs. Our VOA basketball fans will remember Leonard was the most valuable player of the 2014 NBA Finals, during which San Antonio beat the Miami Heat 4-1. Meanwhile, the Heat was also a winner Tuesday night. Miami beat the visiting Charlotte Hornets 105-100. Slovenian guard Goran Dragic scored 28 points for Miami, his highest scoring game for the Heat since coming to Miami in a February trade. And South Sudan-born star Luol Deng scored 21 points for the Heat, which snapped a 4-game losing streak.
They're playing back.
Hey, mates, remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA.
VOA!
And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. And more grease to the sporty elbows of you and your Brilla staff. In addition to Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry has Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. And we're delighted to have them as a partner of the Voice of America. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you check out my Facebook page, you'll see an English Premier League football question of the week on Tuesdays. My VOA colleagues, Tef Tef and Downtown Brown, take a look at your responses to the question and then read them out during Friday's Sunny Side of Sports shows. And on that note, I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the UN says barring remittances from abroad in Somalia could have disastrous effects on the country. And next, the influx of refugees to Djibouti and Somalia from Yemen. But first, some music. Here is Tabuli from the DRC with Paquita.
Volvas pronto, Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi, Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto, Paquita, para bien, que tu madre te guarda, oh, esto es tu espera, quiero que creces pronto, Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi, Paquita,
Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Estoy herido por la flecha de tu belleza y disimulo. Ven, encende mi corazón, está pronto, bella Paquita. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto.
From the DRC with Paquita.
Well, earlier in our show, we heard that the Kenyan government has suspended the licenses of a dozen remittance firms serving Somalis living in Kenya. The move is expected to harm the local Somali community. The move comes within weeks of the decision by a major U.S. bank to stop working with remittance companies serving the Somali community in the United States. The U.N. says remittances from abroad are key to food security in Somalia. Western banks recently decided to bar money transfers into the country. That decision and other anti-terrorism measures could have disastrous effects on the country. Hillary Hewler reports from Nairobi.
In some ways, Kasim Abdikadir is lucky. He works on farms around Afguye near Mogadishu and earns money he can use at the local market. And when he goes to that market, there's food in the stalls. But in Somalia, as in many food insecure countries, the story is never quite that simple. The price of food in the market is so expensive, says Abdikadir, that he cannot even afford to buy grains to feed his children. Somalia's last famine, in 2011, killed an estimated 250,000 people. And the United Nations estimates about 3 million are still in need of some form of food aid. Somalia is certainly an arid country, and the rains do sometimes fail. But recently, the rains have been normal, and the land is capable of growing crops. In some areas, food production is even up, enough that the United Nations is considering buying grain from Somali farmers. So why is Somalia so chronically food insecure? World Food Program in Somalia head Laurent Bukera says one reason is simple logistics.
We have productive regions where some sort of harvest can take place, but the movement of some of the area where there is food to other areas where there is no food is cut off by logistical access constraints. We have still a lot in Somalia of supply roads which are cut off.
Somalia has endured more than 20 years of chaos and violence, and more recently, militants from Al-Shabaab have blocked major supply ways. Several years of military operations by the National Army and African Union forces have reopened some, but not all, of these critical routes. This continues to impact the production of food, Bukera explains, because when a country is unstable, farmers aren't always able to work.
Oftentimes have to flee. And to flee, leaving behind all their belongings, leaving behind their animals, cows, goats, which can give them milk, but also leaving behind everything they have planted.
With more than 1 million people in Somalia internally displaced, they simply don't have access to their land, he adds. And at the moment, Somalia only grows about half the food it needs. The result is a shortage of food in towns and cities, where even those with a little income cannot always afford skyrocketing food prices, says Ed Pomfret of Oxfam's Somalia program.
In certain cities in Somalia, we've seen food prices go up 4 times when there's been a conflict happening around it. Even if the market is working, the conflict causes displacement and it does cause difficulties in terms of food supply into the markets.
This isn't to say that climatic factors don't play a role as well, he adds, as erratic rainfall and encroaching desertification make life more and more difficult for farmers and herders. But Somalia's food situation is complex, says Pomfret, and any solution must be multifaceted.
Tackling the climate change agenda, making sure that we put in place climate change adaptation measures, and also creating a more peaceful Somalia are all factors that will help reduce the levels of food insecurity.
Only if all these factors are addressed, he says, will Somalia stand a chance of being able to feed itself. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the first to flee the conflict in Yemen were 32 Yemeni from Taiz. They crossed the Red Sea and reached the coast of Somaliland and Puntland regions in Somalia. They arrived by boat at the Berbera port after 12 hours at sea. Authorities and refugee officials in Somalia and Djibouti say this was only the beginning of an influx of refugees from Yemen. Harun Maruf reports.
In fact, we have been notified that there might be a high influx of returnees, those who are coming in Puntland. We call a meeting within humanitarian agencies present in Puntland, specifically UNHCR and IOM and the Danish Refugee Council, who particularly focus on this migration or irregular assistance. And we have mobilized our resources that we have, including NFI, including tentage and medication. So in our capacity, we have prepared in our stock, and we will be able to respond whatever number that we might receive.
Tell me exactly the estimated number of people that you are expecting to arrive in Bosaso.
In fact, it is difficult just to give you an exact number, but we are expecting to receive thousands. Though it is a difficulty to say just 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000, but we are expecting a high number. In fact, as I said before, it could be difficult to mention exact number because of our offices in Yemen have been closed due to the security situation.
And what kind of assistance can they expect when they arrive in Bosaso?
First of all, we are going to receive them warmly with the mobilization, and then we immediately are going to give emergency assistance like water, biscuit, NFI, which is non-food items, medication, we have nets. Those are the things that we are going to support while they arrive.
And you are collaborating with the authorities in Somaliland. What can you tell us about the 32 Yemenis who already arrived in Berbera?
In fact, I spoke with my colleagues in UNHCR here in Puntland, and also I spoke with my colleagues based in Hargeisa from IOM, and they have both confirmed that 32 Yemeni citizens arrived in Berbera, And in fact, the report has been shared in late this afternoon, and UNHCR, IOM, and other local authorities are going to meet in Berbera.
That was Harun Maruf reporting. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a clear link between endemic corruption and violent extremism. Corruption on a large scale often results in and from poor governance, leading to the root conditions that too often breed or give sanctuary to violent extremism: anger, moral outrage, and disaffection for a system or society that allows some to thrive through dishonesty at the expense of the rest. Where there is weak governance or a lack of quality education, economic opportunity, or respect for human rights, citizens are most at risk of being alienated by or from their governments and each other, noted Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. This is not just about ideological affinity. It is about alienation and anger that drives communities to align with or tolerate the violent extremists. Thus, ISIL in Iraq was able to exploit disillusionment with corrupt officials to garner support among some of the civilian population, not because they shared ISIL's perverse religious stance, but because both opposed the government. And in some other parts of the world, various violent extremist groups that sow chaos and misery have used corruption and the absence of good governance as a potent recruitment tool, as the Taliban has in Afghanistan. Other violent extremist groups have gained footholds or wreaked havoc in countries where the security forces have been weakened by endemic corruption, as Al-Shabaab has in Somalia and Kenya, or Boko Haram in Nigeria. Corruption is just one of the enablers of violent extremism, and efforts to combat it will need to be taken in concert with a number of policy and programmatic interventions if we are to stem the growth of violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. This includes strengthening civilian institutions so they not only provide security, but provide legal avenues to hold elected officials accountable and respond to the needs of their citizens, ensuring inclusive governance to reduce political or socioeconomic marginalization of particular groups. It means building secure and resilient communities in which the vulnerable don't need to align with extremist groups to address their concerns, said Undersecretary Sewell. And it means weakening the appeal of extremist ideology by amplifying the voices of leaders who promote tolerance, peace, and diversity, and who speak out against violence against civilians. Violent extremists exploit public discontent with corruption to garner support. Thus, eliminating corruption is key to rolling back and marginalizing extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to
these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.